Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
To each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes.
Miriam Schlossberg with us. She's the CEO of Gemini Rising Limited, which provides, listen to it close, businesses with blog design, posting services, mobile websites, professionally designed social media pages. And she offers a 5-day free course brought to the light, the secret to the business building power of the internet. Miriam, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello there, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the word blog, 3 or 4 years ago, most people would have no idea what that meant. You know, we heard the word, but so on and so forth. The power of blogging today has skyrocketed. Miriam, what do you think that caused that?
Well, this is what I believe. Blogs are a way for people to express what they need to express. They're a way for people to connect with the other communities and to connect with, create relationships. I mean, there are so many uses for blogs. And there are so many types of blogs out there as well. You know, I mean, a lot of people in general have a personal blog, which is like basically their online public diary where they can talk about whatever's on their mind. Now, business owners also have or must have blogs in order to share their knowledge and engage with clients and customers to keep them updated on anything new having to do with their product or services. And also, they need blogs in order to attract new customers or clients that could be interested in what they're offering. Blogs are used by schools and for staff and students in order to help one another communicate and collaborate on classroom projects. Politicians use blogs to connect with their constituency and members of the... I'm sorry?
Said I can never say that either.
I know. But members of the military also use blogs to keep in touch with their friends and families to let them know what's been going on during their stressful lives. And many people use blogs to teach others how to do things. And these blogs are basically called the how-to tips or reviews. Nonprofit organizations use blogs to raise awareness about their causes to others. Sports fans and athletes use blogs to express their love and passion for sports. And people may keep create blogs to keep their just for their own sake. You know, they keep like private online diaries for themselves or their families. So, you know, sure. You can see that the use for blogs, it's so diverse.
No. By the way, if somebody properly knows how to use a website, monetizes a website, you can make a lot of money from your website. But what you're saying is blogs are actually more profitable than websites for business owners now.
Absolutely. And I'm going to tell you why. Okay. Ordinary websites do not give web owners any opportunities really to share their knowledge about their niches. I mean, you know, of course they can do that by creating different pages, but it's dry. I mean, business owners can't really express what they know or feel on an ongoing basis through blogging just by having an ordinary website. Blogs can provide business owners to share their knowledge, to talk about anything new that people need to know about their businesses, and business owners can even express opinions and feelings professionally, which will help connect with clients easily as well. Because whenever a client empathizes with what the blog owner says, that immediately creates a relationship between the client and business owner, and relationships are necessary in order to form any kind of business, like to create any kind of business. So an ordinary website doesn't do that. It doesn't provide the kind of warmth that blogs do.
One of the problems I see facing a business, and I run into the same thing myself. I've blogged, and I've got blogs up on the website, and I've got people after me to blog. But then you get busy. It's very hard, And by the way, I'm totally behind blogs, so don't hear anything on the other side of the fence with it or the table with it. But sometimes it is so hard to sit down and write a blog, even if it's, you know, a half a page to a page. You get so involved, and the next thing you know, you turn around, you look back at the day and said, where did my blog time go?
Yeah, no, that's no problem, because Gemini Rising Limited actually provides a posting service. And we create posts for business owners, and they have full rights to it. We use it from private label rights material, and we make it as if it was you saying it, and you own complete rights to it. Now, one thing that I do suggest is try to make some time once in a while to blog in order to, like, express something that's from the depths of your soul, because that's what's also going to attract clients. But for something ongoing, no problem. We can help with that.
Okay, so in essence, you're there, quote unquote, to hold my hand.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, there's no better way to say that. There's so many people who have great ideas, and they're very creative, and a lot of the ideas that they have will hit right to the core of the problems that a lot of people are facing that don't know how to get an answer to. And blogging can be that kind of an answer. But then again, too, here's the other problem somebody runs into, and you just mentioned the fix to it. Let's say I blog. Okay, where do I put it? Who's going to read my blog? Where's it going to go? So I know that other people out there who have a similar want, need, desire, whatever the case is, will see my blog.
Okay, well, there's a simple solution. It's called search engine optimization, and we, Gemini Rising Limited, provides that. What that is that we, it's a process where we get your blog seen, not just through on the search engines, but on the first page of Google, Yahoo, Bing, or whatever. It's a process that utilizes keywords having to do with your blog and keywords that people look for, okay? So that's something that we offer to make your blog known, because you're right. If you have a blog and it's just sitting out there, who's going to see it? But this is where search engine optimization or SEO comes into play.
By the way, I love everything that you have to say, and I intentionally did not want to talk to you last month. And would you guess why?
Okay.
No, take a wild guess why.
You didn't want to talk to me last month?
Yeah. Take a wild guess why. Did I mention to everybody you are also an astrologer, right?
Yes.
Mercury.
Actually, no, you didn't.
Wait, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I should mention Mercury.
Oh, okay. This is what we're going into. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Mercury was in retrograde.
Absolutely.
And it was a brutal one.
Yes.
Yeah.
New ideas during Mercury do not work. Anyway.
Yeah, you don't do anything. And you know what? I conveniently forgot about that, which is great. And the kinks are finally getting ironed out once and for all. So that's good. It was a brutal one.
Yeah, you know what's amazing with that, with most people, and I know some about astrology. I'm no expert. But at the same time, if anybody doesn't think when Mercury goes into retrograde that communications and everything else is going to go haywire, check your computer out, check your phone lines out, and anything that has to do with communication is falling down. And if you're waiting for that moment when they're going to say yes, forget about it.
Oh, wow, yeah. No kidding. And, you know, it's funny that you say that, because Mercury rules the sign Gemini, and Gemini is what rules communication and movement and networking and all that. And this is why I came up with the name. And you want to hear something else funny? While Mercury was in retrograde, there were a lot of issues that came with Gemini rising. However, one thing I got to say, whenever you have Mercury retrograde, it's a pain. You got a lot of stuff to a lot of issues to face, and everything just fails on you. But once Mercury's in a better position, once it's direct, things get better. And you learn from what happened, and you improve it. And this is exactly what Gemini Rising is in the middle. We are going through some big changes to make things even better. So we're hoping it'll be done by the end of the month.
You know, I can tell when it happens, because once a year, for the last 5-6 years, just about the time it starts, I get a phone call from Radio Suzy saying, I'm never going to talk to you again. And I'm thinking, okay, wait, call me back in 3 weeks. It'll be over with. I can always tell when it happens. All right, now we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. A website where we can find you at. I think you have a phenomenal concept and an idea here.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Oh, okay, are you having trouble hearing me?
I think Mercury is still throwing little kinks out. Okay, now it's a little better. Okay, go ahead, sorry.
Oh, okay, what's going on? Am I too low for you?
No, now you're good.
Okay, anyway, we're running out of time. Website we can find you at.
Okay, it's www.GeminiRisingLTD.com, and that's GeminiRisingLTD.com. Now, we're going through a lot of changes, so you're going to be really impressed with it by the end of the month.
Now, by the way, one quick question. Is sure. Mercury, I know it went back to retrograde a week or two ago. When is it over with?
Oh, actually, it thankfully ended on the 26th of August.
Yeah.
It went into retrograde actually on August 3rd. But the thing is, we still have energies from the retrograde that we're dealing with once in a while. And that's going to be lasting until actually Friday. That's when things are going to finally get better. Things are going to finally improve.
And then at the end of the month, things are going to fly?
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. I'm just getting ready. This is just the start.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being with us, and I've appreciated your time.
And thank you for having me.
Oh, take care. Good night.
Take care. Bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and the
Caribbean.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona.
Marie Gates with us has a master's degree in psychology and has taught at various colleges and universities. She has spent the last 30 years researching the topic of reincarnation. And her latest book is Are We Our Past Lives? Soul Patterns and Personalities and Relationships. And let's say, Marie, I welcome to the show.
Well, I'm very, very happy to be with you. I feel honored to be with someone who has done thousands of interviews, I'm sure with a lot of authors.
Oh, it's been there. There's been a couple under my belt. And as a matter of fact,
okay.
There could have been a past life I might have done this before. We get it. What is it, Marie, that caused you to really take a look at the issue of past lives and take it on as a very serious topic and issue?
Well, I was an instructor at the University of Alabama when I met a student who knew a hypnotist who did past life regressions. And when she asked me if I were interested, at first I thought, oh, I don't know. I really didn't believe in it. At the time, I was actually an agnostic. I didn't know what to believe, and it was not a comfortable feeling. I didn't feel good about being an agnostic because I thought, what if I should die suddenly in a car accident? What would happen? Would I just no longer exist, or would I go on to another world, or what would happen? So I wasn't sure, but what made me go to the hypnotist was a very strange dream that I'd had. And it was in a different world. I was a woman with a man. We were human, but it was on a different planet or in a different reality. And this reality was so peaceful and beautiful that I did not want to leave it. And when my husband awakened me, I was angry. Of course, I made up with him later on. It wasn't a grudge that I ever held, but I wanted to be in this world. And so in order to maybe uncover a past life, I decided to go to the hypnotist. And we did uncover 5 past lives. And one was of a woman who was involved with someone from a different world, but again, he looked as human as you or me. And she'd had an abusive relationship with her husband, had 2 children, wound up leaving her family and going off with the lover from the different world. And they crashed when they were going to the mothership. They were in a smaller ship, and that was the end of that life. Now, I was really perplexed. I wonder how this could happen. Why was I having this strange dream, and then again going into hypnosis and finding more information about it. So when we moved back to Michigan, this is my native state, my husband said, why don't you go and look and see if you can find any evidence of this past life in Connecticut? So I did. As soon as I got into town, I checked into the hotel, and then I walked to the library. And I understood that where I would look to find people from the past would be in the city directories. Now, this family, my husband and I in that life, lived in the 1940s in this New Haven, and, of course, before that as well. So I looked in the 1940s in the city directories, and lo and behold, the husband's name was right there. And I give his name as a pseudonym in my book because I want to protect the privacy of the family. I gave his name as Jacob Randall. And so I looked up his name, and there it was. And there was my name in the past life and the address where they lived. So the next day, I took a bus out to the building where they lived. And at first, I looked at it, and I thought, is this possible? You know, it was a liquor store. But I walked in the store, and I found out that there were apartments above and behind it, so they could have lived there. And I talked to the proprietor. He was a young man, and he was buying the building from the landlord from the 1940s, where that family had lived there. And so he gave me the name of the landlord and his phone number. I went back to the hotel, called him up. The old landlord gave me the name of the married name of the girl who had grown up there. And so I called her and started talking. And at first I thought, well, I better not say I'm looking for your mother in the past life. I just said I'm interested in genealogy. But she never asked me why I had chosen her family. I thought that was kind of strange. But she was a very open person, very friendly. And so she told me about her mother's life. It had been very rough that she had to support the family during the Depression. She worked as a stenographer for the A&P grocery store chain. And the husband was unemployed for a while, working for the DPW. She had a very hard life because she'd have to work all day and then take the streetcar to home and then prepare dinner. And on Saturday, it was especially hard because she would have to iron the wash. They would send it to the wet wash because they weren't like in the suburbs where they would have clotheslines to hang their clothes. They would have to send it to the wet wash. It would come back wet, and they'd have to iron all day Saturday. They must have ironed the sheets and the towels and not just the clothing. So it was a rough life. And I thought, you know, it doesn't sound familiar from what I had said during hypnosis. She didn't make any mention of an abusive father. And so I asked her how the father treated her. Oh, no, he wasn't abusive or anything. And then I wondered about the man on the side, you know. No, there wasn't any. And so I thought, what's going on here? And but from doing my research on reincarnation, I realized that if anyone is to recall a past life, it almost always is because the death was either violent or premature. So then I focused on the death, and I said, how did your mother die? Oh, she was preparing the apartment for her brother, who was coming home after World War II, and everything had to be perfect. She wore herself out. She apparently had an ulcer before. I'm not sure if it was being treated, but her ulcer started bleeding, and she had to go to the hospital. Well, I asked where did she go, and it was to a Catholic hospital because that was the father's background, he insisted. And then it rang a bell. I had remembered myself as dying in a hospital bed with nuns in attendance. And when she said Catholic hospital, well, they would have been wearing their habits. When I was a young child, I didn't realize what Catholicism meant and the nuns wore habits, but I recalled that. And then I also recalled my daughter being with me when I died. So I asked her if she was, and she said, yes, I held her hand. She had gone to the hospital to visit her mother before going to work, and it was 6 a.m. when the mother died, and she held her hand, and I can still remember her and her long wool coat and scarf. That's what they wore in those days. And and there it was. It was my memory that I had from childhood that no one could explain. My mother said it was a dream, but I know it wasn't a dream because I recalled it while I was awake. And I was born almost to the day 3 months later after Amanda died.
And now, Marie, let me ask you a couple things. I've been listening very intent to you. Now, how many past lives did you have?
I have been able to uncover 19 past lives. Some of them were from hypnosis, and others of them were from spiritual healers, which I focused on in Are We Our Past Lives. Okay. I have a chapter for nine of these past lives.
Okay, now, was there an overarching theme through each life? You know, the lesson to be learned in a life, whatever that may be for every individual, is it the same lesson? Is it in the 19 lives, was there an overarching theme? There's something that you didn't get and you had to keep coming back to get it done, or did you get it done and have to move on to the next one? There's got to be something that ties them all together.
Okay, there are personality characteristics. That's why I call the book the subtitle is Soul Patterns and Personalities and Relationships. Everybody has a certain personality that come into life with. It's designed to help them resolve their karma from past lives. And I can only give examples of individual personality characteristics or relationship challenges, you might say, and that go from one life to another. Now, one that I have in mind is from the life that I was able to investigate the most was that of Jacob Gruber, who was a minister in the 19th century in the Methodist Church. He was a circuit rider, but he also was stationed at certain churches. And I was able to go to one of the churches where he was pastor in Baltimore. Well, the thing about this life was he was a very good man. He was religious. He was very charitable. He gave the church a lot of money, even though he didn't have much himself. He was sacrificing himself all the time. Like, instead of stopping for food at a tavern, he might just get food from the people that he was working with. Like, he might be staying with the family when he was on the circuit. So in many ways, he was a good man, but he had one, I would say, fatal flaw, and that was he was arrogant, and he pushed his values on other people. I think this might have been common, and maybe still is today among certain ministers, where they think they're right, and everybody else, if they have behaviors that the minister doesn't agree with, to come down hard on them, like Jacob Gruber would pull cigars from men's mouths, and one time he got sued for it, but he won. He won the lawsuit. Also, he got in a great deal of trouble for speaking out against slavery. This was, of course, before the Civil War. He died in 1850, and he went to court over that, but he was exonerated. But he complained about having to spend a lot of money for his defense. But I think the biography, The Life of Jacob Gruber, was written mainly because he was somewhat famous for going to court for speaking out against slavery.
Hmm. Well, we're starting. Let me hold you. We're starting to run out of time. That's okay. No, okay. You're delightful. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's Marie Gates, MarieGates.com.
Okay,
and
you it's
have an
Marie Gates
website.
Wonderful. If somebody missed it, it'll be up on our website.
Okay, thank you.
By the way, where was the hypnotist at? What state?
This was in Alabama. He is now deceased.
Okay. All right, and by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Oh, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
Some of these days, you're gonna miss me, baby. Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging on you. Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really grieve me, you're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if for you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. what your child needs to know about sex and when. This is a Straight Talking Guide for Parents. Dr. Fred Kayser is with us. He is the former director of health at the New York City Department of Education. And let's say, Fred, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Real pleasure.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I truly believe in my heart of hearts that a book like this, the time for it to come out is now. The window of opportunity is here. I think there is so much confusion with the media and what kids should know and what kids shouldn't know and what they get taught in grammar school on and the laws that the different states are making. I think it's very confusing for a parent today.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably harder today than it was 30 years ago. I mean, a lot harder than my parents when I was growing up. You know, kids are literally being super sexualized today in today's society. And, you know, and the one thing I learned over the years, I've been doing this for over 30 years, and, you know, things really haven't changed a whole lot in terms of how bad things are. You know, in fact, I think it is getting worse. You know, you look at what parents are up against today. Half of all teenagers in America have had sexual intercourse. About 65% of 17-year-olds have had intercourse. Of those that have had sex, they've had on average 4 different sexual partners. 1 in 10 females have been forced to have sex at least once. 1 in 5 females who are sexually active have been forced to have sexual intercourse at least once in their relationship. Oral sex is just as high as sexual intercourse in terms of incidence. Sexually transmitted infections among teenagers, all-time high. And I think what really makes it worse today is the face of teenage sexual behavior is getting younger and younger. Sure. About 1 in 12 kids in America today will have sexual intercourse before age 13. Now think about that. 1 out of every 12 sixth graders, when I go into a class of sixth graders, I sit there and I think to myself, 1 in every 12 have had sexual intercourse.
Let me hold you up for a minute. Let me hold you up.
Sure.
That when I know that oral sex seems to be not quote unquote sex to them, so that's okay. But when you talk about the grammar school kids, are we talking about physical, literal sex? Or are we talking about oral sex?
Yeah, it's you know, the data, the younger the kids are, the more difficult it is to obtain data. So we do look retrospectively. So there's a good database on middle school kids. And we'll ask them, when did you have your first sexual experience in terms of intercourse? And, you know, depending upon location in the country, and we're looking somewhere at around, about 1 in 12 sixth graders, certain locations around the country, Alabama, for example, about 1 in 10 fifth graders report having sexual intercourse. In Delaware, it's slightly 6% or so. In Mississippi, about 8%. These are all CDC, Centers for Disease Control statistics. We actually study the sexual behaviors of high school kids and middle school kids in America every 2 years. We've been doing so for about 2 decades. And, you know, again, statistics fluctuate somewhat, but something that's really been emerging is this younger and younger face, of sexual behavior. Kids who molest kids. I can't tell you how many cases of 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old kids that have been brought to my attention over 25 years with the New York City Department of Ed, kids molesting other kids. The emergence of the sexual bully is something that we did not see 15 years ago. You know, as all kids get sexualized, the bullies, the emerging bullies of the world, are getting sexualized. And they're learning very, very early that using sexual behavior is far more intimidating than punching or pushing or shoving or using verbal threats. So the sexual bully is a fairly new phenomenon. Parents didn't deal with this 20 years ago.
No, as a matter of fact, let me even take you back farther than that. When we're dealing with sexuality, it's the permissiveness. I was brought up in the 50s. I graduated high school in 1960. And in those days, I remember one girl got pregnant and they hustled her off. And in those days, it was the Doris Day movies. And the law was that there was always, if there was a bedroom scene, it was 1 foot on the floor, that was it. They couldn't get together. Then obviously they opened it up after the 60s, and I think a lot of this is that's going on. It's the kids are modeling after the movies. I turned my cable on at about 2 o'clock in the morning in the last week or two, and I popped it on. I'm going through the channels, and what I run into, there's a movie called The Hills Have Thighs, and I don't have to tell you what it was about. But the point is you can get it on television. You can get it, you know, they can get it at home. It's all over the place in the movies.
Oh, yeah.
And it's
you're one click away on the internet.
Yeah, and
you're
when
one
I say,
click away on the internet, some real wacky, bizarre sexual behavior.
Yeah, yeah, and
there are a lot of kids.
I'm not a moralist. I'm a pragmatist. But it's a very interesting catch 22. Do you stop the rhetorically? Do you stop the free speech? Do you stop everything that's going on in the internet?
No.
Do you control what goes on in the movies? Or what do you do?
And that I think is a big message in the book that I wrote is you can't put your kid in a closet. You know, you can't walk around the block when you got to go just, you know, across the street to get where you're going. And so you can't hide your kid. But what you do have to do is stand up and take some responsibility as a parent. Just start talking. You know, there's incredible research out there that says if parents just take certain simple steps, this is not rocket science, Mr. Dresser. This is very simple stuff. And I'm going to talk about what those steps are in just a few minutes. It's when parents become approachable, they become the number one source of sexual information and guidance for their children. They're more influential than any public school sex education program. They're more influential than the media, more influential than the peers and the kids' peers and friends. And that is clear empiricism. That's research. When parents talk early and often enough about sex with their child, they're winners. When they share their values and clearly articulate with their kids what's right and wrong with regard, you know, in terms of different sexual behavior, they're winners. When they hammer home the importance of love, respect, and trust, I tell you, I can go into a middle school, I can go into a high school, and I hear it all the time. Dr. Fred, he loves me, she loves me, he'll never leave me, he'll always be there for me. And I just stare and look at them and say, you know, about 9 out of 10 kids, you become pregnant, about 9 out of 10 boys are going to leave you. And that's the reality. I could spend an entire year. Parents have to hammer. How do you know when you're in love? How do you know when you have the respect of someone else? How do you know when you have trust? Could you think about this? If you're going to lay down with someone, if you're going to be sexual with someone, and you understand that you really do have true love, true respect, mutual trust, sexual risk lowers dramatically. You can't hide your kids, Mr. Dresser, but you do have to talk to them, and you do have to balance your sex talks. You know, sex is like a coin. Sex creates life. It can also kill you. What an interesting juxtaposition that is. The same
absolutely.
Behavior that creates
when you take a look at this, sex is not what's the physical act, yes, but sex, the definition of sex today is not what the definition of it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. There's a whole new feeling about it, and there's a movement. Some of the parents today are nothing more than the kids that we were yelling at, don't go to bed with your boyfriend, you know, 10, 12 years ago. So there is a value system that has been generated and that has become the base of what these kids do today. And the biggest problem we have with the quote-unquote advent of the internet and the texting and all the technology, how many kids really respect their parents today? Parents, they don't know anything. That's one of the problems that we run into. And I absolutely am behind you on this. So don't hear I'm on the opposite
side. No. I know you are. But you know what's really interesting? Research after research tells us that teenagers want to hear more from their parents. Isn't that interesting? When I'm standing in front of a group of parents of high school kids or middle school kids, they look at me like I'm crazy. My kid doesn't want to talk to me. My kid has turned me off. I cannot compete with the media or my kids' peers. And yet research, empirical evidence, says just the opposite, that kids want to hear more from their parents. And believe me, I'm a parent of a teenager, and there are times I hit my head against the wall saying, that can't be true, Dr. Fred, that can't be true. But research tells us over and over again, kids want to hear from us. So I tell parents, even though kids may not be talking back at you, do not worry about that. Just keep on talking, because down deep, they want to know more from you. So, you know, with all of this
competing
influence.
Let me hold you up for a minute. Let me back that up.
Yeah.
And it backs up this way. We look for, the human being looks for acceptance. Out of acceptance, you create something called identity. And if you're not being accepted by your parents, you're going to go out and find it somewhere else and create your identity with someone else, with another group, with something. It could be a gang. It could be any number of things. So you're spot on with the parents, except the parents aren't getting that. If the parents are not accepting that teenager in the way that the teenager has learned from wherever of what acceptance is and have the ability to recognize acceptance, they're going to be rejected and they're going to go off someplace else and get accepted somewhere else. And if it happens to be in bed, then that's the way it is and that's where they get their identity.
And clearly that is happening. But you know what? There is good news here. You know, when I'm talking to a group of middle school parents, far more kids in middle school aren't having sex than are having sex. Far more kids in ninth grade aren't having sex than those that are having sex. You know, about a little less than 50% of kids are having sexual intercourse in the country today. And you got to figure, a proportion of those kids are having sexual intercourse with someone they really do care for, and there really is good mutual respect and trust. As bad as things seem, it could be a whole lot worse. I think parents just, they're like you and I. They grew up without a whole lot of sexual education themselves.
How about innocent?
Much less parenting education, huh?
Another word? How about we grew up innocent? Compared to what they learned today,
I'd love to be able to say we could do that, eh?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? But the world ain't going back, right?
Yeah,
it is what it is today, you know. And I tell parents, 10 is the new 16. In other words, everything you thought a 16-year-old needs to know about sex and sexuality, a 10-year-old now needs to know. When I'm in a group of fifth graders, I tell fifth grade parents, I tell them, look at everything is on the table. You've got to be having conversations with your child right now about when to have sex, with whom to have sex, what are the conditions that you are the best to have sex under. You know, go back to that love, respect, and trust. Constantly point out examples of how do you know when you can really respect someone and trust someone and love someone. I'll tell you, those three words are the biggest sex words. When I go in front of a group of kids, I'll tell them, I'm going to tell you right now the three biggest sex words in the book. And they look at me and they think, oh, man, he's going to say a whole bunch of stuff right now. And I tell them love, respect, and trust. And they're like, what? And if you think about it, how important it is to have those three ingredients. Talking about sexual feelings. I tell parents all the time, parents of kids that are 9 and 10 years of age, now is the time to start talking about sexual feelings. You do not want your ninth grader to be sitting in a park with that drop-dead gorgeous guy or girl coming by who she knows or he knows has flirted with her on occasion or him on occasion, and suddenly that person sits down and touches their leg and their heart is bad. That is not the time to start to think about how I'm going to manage my sexual feelings. It is never too early. That is a message I always tell parents, but it can be too late. Homosexuality is starting at 3, 4, and 5, 6 years of age, talking about your body, talking about private parts, talking about the type of partner you think they might one day fall in love with, constantly pointing out those references of what makes for a good partner, what makes for a good relationship. It's not too young to talk about intercourse with a 5-year-old. Sperm cell, egg cell, and you know, if they ask how does a sperm cell meet the egg cell, well, penis goes into the woman's vagina, and by that time they're like, oh, that's gross and disgusting. Yes, but I love you, sweetheart. Always come to mommy, always come to daddy. This is private talk between you and me. We're going to have plenty of talk like this, and don't ever be shy about asking questions about any of this stuff. And then
let's add something to this mix, too, and I really believe it's extremely important, especially with the girls, with the young ones. It's the awareness of at 13, 14, 15 years old, your body is not ready for that. And let's face it, they're not the 20, 21-year-olds where their body is, or 18, whatever the age is, where they're ready for that. And getting pregnant at 14 or 15 years old will stop your life. And that's those are some of the things that they've got to get. And most of them don't have
yes.
the ability for the responsibility of having a child. And there's these other ways to look at it. I remember when I learned about sex. I can see it right now. I'm in the back seat of the car. There's like five or six of the guys, and we're in a car club, and we're driving around town. We're doing our stuff in the 50s. And one of them mentioned something about sex, and they were talking about it. And I looked at him, and I said, I remember the words coming out of my mouth. My mom and dad don't do that. And who thought, right? So I learned they did.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, but, well, look, I mean, you know, sex isn't all bad, right? And that's a message we do have to give to our kids. I totally agree that a message to our kids about waiting till adulthood to have, you know, to be sexually active in terms of intercourse is absolutely the way to go. At the same time, acknowledging with your young kid that, you know, you are a sexual person. You are going to have sexual feelings. You know, I tell every parent, you've got to start thinking about what are your thoughts? Have you communicated with your child about kissing, about tongue kissing, about feeling up, feeling down, feeling over the clothes, feeling under the clothes? These are conversations you have to have with your child, and you've got to do it early. I'll tell you, before middle school, all of that has to be addressed. The earlier you begin, Mr.
Yeah,
Dressing,
prep them.
The better
yeah.
off you're going to be.
No, I got it.
The
by the way,
the better off you're going to be.
We're starting to yeah. run out of time. I could talk to you about this all
yeah.
night. I think you're spot on with everything
oh,
that you're saying. I should. It should happen in before middle school to prep them before the problems start. When they get into a situation and they don't have the options and choices of what to do about it, they think they're stuck, and this is what they have to do.
Well, listen, I appreciate this time. You just, you know, it's all in the book. It's laid out. It's like you and I are sitting on the couch talking just like we are right now. That's exactly the way I communicate all this in the book. And, you know, this is not rocket science. And I'll tell you, the good news here is all you have to do is just start to talk. That's
now,
the key
here.
Do you have
a website we can find you at?
I sure do. It's Dr. Fred Kaeser. That's KAESER.com. And there's plenty of information on there. There's plenty of the stuff that we were talking about tonight. You can order the book from there. And let's step up to the plate, parents.
I hear you. Hey, Fred, thank you so much. Great job you're doing, and thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you so much, Mr. Dresser. Bye-bye now.
Take care. Good night.
Splish, splash, I was taking a bath long about a Saturday night. Rub-dub, just relaxing in the tub. I'm thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, I put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And then a splish, splash, I jumped back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing, reeling with the feeling, moving and a grooving, rocking and a rolling. Bing bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug. Flip-flop, they were doing the bop. All the tunes had the dancing bug. There was Lollipop with a Peggy Sue. Good and golly, Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on. I was a splishing and a splashing. I was a rolling and a strolling. Yeah, I was a man.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk and Splashing Wet Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back with us, Susan Marshall, President Executive Advisor, LLC, How to Grow a Backbone. That's the book, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work, and the creator of the Backbone Institute. Susan, welcome back.
Hi, Michael Ray.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It is an absolutely spectacularly beautiful evening here in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
lovely, lovely evening.
Yeah, but if I go outside, I don't know if I can be successful at it.
Are you feeling down, Bunky?
I could
That's
fail
funny.
if I I could fail if I went outside.
Uh-huh. Yes,
yeah.
You could.
They might not like the way I look. I could step in water. I don't know what could happen.
Well, you know, it's splish splash. You probably would.
Yeah.
You know what? I'd love to pick up on that and talk this evening about the big three confidence killers. The big three.
Yeah.
And as I've listened to people and done this work over almost 30 years now and read books and read magazine articles, I always try to look for patterns, and I try to look for things that really are defining with regard to any particular topic. And confidence, as you know, is kind of my deal. And the three things, the big three confidence killers are failure, loss, and fear. And you could make the argument that those are different shades of the same color black, but they're really not. And by black, I mean disappointment, nothing else. So if we think about, I want to talk kind of independently about each one of those, and then I want to talk about, okay, if those are the big three confidence killers, how can we overcome them?
Okay, I'm going to ask you to ask me a question, okay?
Okay.
Ask me if I've ever failed in anything.
Michael, have you ever failed in anything?
Not once.
So tell me why that is.
How can you fail? Everything in life is a lesson. How can you fail when you get something up against you, you get this challenge, you fall on your rear end, and you realize that there's something even better behind it if you move forward? Have I ever failed? Absolutely not.
Let me ask, when did you come to the conclusion that there was no such thing as failure, there was simply a result?
20-some years ago, probably.
Yeah. And I think this is where the root evil, if we can look at it that way, we are all conditioned at a very early age to see failure as a negative. Somehow, somewhere along the way, from the time where, maybe it's when we get M&Ms when we're potty trained, I don't know, but somehow we get the notion that life is supposed to progress along a smooth and relatively uninterrupted upward trajectory. That's false. And so we get, you know, the prince and the princess got married and they live happily ever after. They're fairy tales and they're myths. And yet, as children, we want to please our parents, we want to please our teachers, we want to please authority people, and so we get conditioned that their expectation, whatever that is, and whether we even understand it or not, is the goal. And if we somehow don't make the goal, we've failed. And it becomes a personal deficiency that we then begin to be afraid of, that we begin to be ashamed of, and we're not generally helped throughout all those very early developmental years to say, no, look, you produced an outcome. Was it the outcome that you wanted? Was it something different than that? If it was different than that, let's pull it apart and say, how did we get that outcome? And if we wanted something, if we wanted an A on the test and we got a B minus or a C, what do we need to do differently to get an A on that test? This is where, in my mind, parents and teachers and coaches and all kinds of people can help us understand it's not personal. And yet we learn very, very early on it becomes personal because we get a sense of disappointment and, stronger than that sometimes, a rejection. Kids experience the rejection of, you know, a parent. I can remember my dad saying this to me with good reason in my wild teenage years. I'm disappointed in you. I was devastated to hear that.
Yeah.
And yet I needed to hear that because, you know, what I was doing was, quite frankly, disappointing.
You mean you weren't studying to be a doctor?
I was not studying to be a doctor, and I was
closing
bars
with
more frequency than, you know, he was real happy about. But the whole notion again of failure, we've got to be able to slow down, calm down, and say, okay, rather than say I failed, I'm a failure, I'm deficient, I'm no good, I'm ashamed of myself, I can't go outside, I don't want anybody to see me. We got to start developing a mindset of more of curiosity and learning. Okay, gosh, that wasn't the outcome I expected. I wonder why. What happened? Let me retrace the steps. let me put the thing together, because you're right, that a failure is simply a result.
By the way, let me hold you up. As you're talking, I just wrote something down, and we'll sell T-shirts, okay?
Cool.
I'm serious. Failure was created to make the other guy look good.
Failure was created to make the other guy look good.
The other guy look good, yeah. Yeah. See, if you can't do it, he or she can.
Yeah.
You got it? And I think failure in and of itself can be a wonderful tool to control people.
Ah, yes. Well,
so failure was created to make the other guy look good.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, good. And it's true, and that is often an outcome. And to make the other guy look good, and to set you off balance, to take you out of the game. Very interesting. J.K. Rowling, the writer of all the Harry Potter things, said something absolutely wonderful about failure, and I think it's worth considering. She said, failure means a stripping away of the inessential.
Yeah.
And when you think about what happens when you don't get the outcomes you want, you learn things, but you do strip away. You waste time. You waste energy. You're doing things that are not taking you toward where you're trying to go. They're not taking you toward your goal. Strip it away. Get rid of it. So I just thought that was really very, very good. So I think the whole notion of failure, we've got to stop thinking about it as a personal deficiency or something that, you know, we can't do anything about, perhaps, that we've got to try to avoid it like the plague. And Dennis Waitley, who was also one of my favorite authors many years ago, said that failure is not only, it's not defeat, it's a temporary detour. But he said, the only way you can avoid failure is by saying nothing, doing nothing, and being nothing. And when I look at the lack of confidence and I look at the fear and just the uncertainty that surrounds so many of the things we're dealing with today, that's what people are starting to do. They're punting. I'm not going to say anything so you can't attack me. I'm not going to do anything so you can't tell me I'm wrong. Ultimately, I'm not going to be anything, and somebody else can take care of me. Wow, we have to fight that big time. So that's the one of the big three confidence killers is failure. The next one is loss. And whenever I hear people kind of bemoaning loss, certainly there's a grieving process that we need to go through. And I don't want to tie confidence to grieving because they're very, very different things. And they're not related in the most important sense of those words. So when you suffer a loss, you lose a loved one, you lose a friend, you lose a relationship, you lose money, substantial amounts of money recently in the stock market. The question that I always have to ask people is, what does that particular loss have to do with you? What did you do or not do to create that particular loss? And in most cases, when people sit and sort through facts and, you know, information and kind of get past the cloud of grief, in most cases, not all, but most cases, the large majority of cases, there was nothing the person could have done to prevent the loss. And so the question then becomes, after you suffer a loss, and by the way, bad things happen to everybody. How we react to them not only determines our character, right? We hear that all the time, but it also determines our quality of life. If we cannot adjust to a new reality, if we cannot strip away some of the inessentials, if we cannot, on the backside of a loss, be okay, then we've got to have some professional help, because that's more than just loss of confidence. So a loss invites us to regroup, to take a look at the new set of facts we're dealing with. And you and I both dealt with this, all right? I've lost my marriage. I've lost my marriage partner. I may be happy about that. I may be sad about that. But that creates a whole new set of life facts that I have to sit and process, that I have to make some new decisions about what I'm going to do next. And so post-loss, the question that we want to ask ourselves is, given this reality, what do I want to do now? And that typically does not come early on the heels of a loss, because there is a grieving process. We have to go through that, and some people need more help with that than others. But once we're coming out sort of the backside of the grieving process, given this reality, what do I want to do now? Which is confidence enabling. I won't say confidence building, because that's a little bit strong, but it helps us recognize that we do have choices. And that's always confidence enhancing. And then the third of the big three is fear. And this is one that seems to be running amok. We see it in the flash mobs. We see it in the violence. We see it in just the horrible vitriolic language. We see it in people not trusting each other and, you know, I'm going to hurt you before you hurt me. And the question that I always like people to consider when they calm down is, how do you choose what to fear? And a number of years ago, I was working with a woman. I think I may have told the story once before. She was a senior executive at a big, big hospital group, healthcare group, and she wanted to be part of the senior leadership, the ultimate high-level senior leadership decision-making group, and she wasn't. And she was very meek. She was very timid. She had a very little mouthy voice, which drove me crazy, so I can only imagine what it did to her colleagues. But she was very, very good at pulling teams together and designing new healthcare facilities and getting the whole thing done. Extraordinarily effective in getting people to work, but very timid in her own person. So we did a 360, which is one of the things that the healthcare system was doing at the time. And then I sat down with her to go through it. And before we could get to any of the results from the 360 evaluation, she started to cry. And I asked her why she was crying. And she said, I'm afraid this information is going to hurt me. She was afraid of it. And I asked, how do you decide what hurts you? And she had never in her 50-some years of life ever considered that she could choose to let information hurt her, she could fear it, or she could simply accept it as information and decide then what she wanted to do with it. Listen to it, reject it, set it aside, say, great, I'll think about that some more. But she never considered she had the choice to be afraid or to be objective. And so when we ask people, well, how do you choose what to fear, it really helps them kind of take a step back and go, huh, some of this is just bad habit. Some of these are old tapes that I've been taught from, you know, very early on. Don't ride your bicycle without, you know, the training wheels when we're little. Put your helmet on. Don't walk after dark. You know, take your flashlight to the parking garage. Now, there are some safety things, obviously, which we do, but we scare ourselves sometimes with imagination. And when people can say out loud, I'm scared, that's when they start to overcome it. If we look at fear, fear is pain. Here's what I wanted to say. Fear is pain arising from the anticipation of evil. Okay, and I think that's fair. We're scared when we anticipate something bad is going to happen.
Sure.
Confidence is exactly the opposite of that. Confidence is the anticipation of goodness. So if we can take fear and walk around to the other side of it and say, what about this can I use to my benefit? Fear is energy. How do I use this energy to either see a situation more clearly, look at other options I have, rewind and retape my tapes? I can overcome fear by making up my mind to do so. Ralph Waldo Emerson, who's one of my absolute favorite writers of all time, wrote a wonderful little book called Self-Reliance, which, of course, people like you and I kind of eat up. But he said, fear defeats more people than any other one thing in the world. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's why FDR, in his inaugural address in 1933, I think, there's nothing to fear but fear itself.
No, and by the way, one thing, we're starting to run out of time, but I want to tell you a quick story. and I was probably about 6 years old. It's got to do with fear. I was about 6 years old. I'm sitting in the kitchen with my mother, and her one of her best friends, who was the neighbor, was in the kitchen. Now, I'm 5 or 6 years old. I looked up under the woman's dress, and I said something, and my mom, she missed me, and she chased me down. This is a true story. She chased me down the hallway, and I went to make a right into my room, and the room was pitch black. I stopped dead. I spent, I don't know how many years, and she caught me, by the way, but I don't know how many. Yeah, we don't want to talk about that part. That was in the days when she wasn't worried about my attorney coming after her.
Yes.
That was political correctness. But for the next probably 30 years, 35 years, I was frightened, maybe 40 years, I take that back. I was frightened to death of the dark. I just, whatever it was, I couldn't stay in a dark room. If there was something dark, I'd be scared.
Yeah.
And I remember one night, I'm laying in bed, and something was bothering me, and I had tears in my eyes. And I got really angry, and I got really tired of being scared. And I walked into the living room in the dark, and I said, if you want me, come and get me right now. Goodbye, with a couple of four-letter expletives. Felt better. Okay. And it went away.
Nothing happened.
It was like Mark Twain. Do the thing you fear most, and the death of fear is certain.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can remember similarly. I used to be really afraid of having my covers. In the summertime, we had no air conditioning, and my sister and I shared a bed, and it was always just so, so hot. And you couldn't take your PJs off because that would be, you know, just very improper behavior, even though you're with your sister. So we would go, and we'd put our heads down where our feet used to be, just switch sides of the bed because it was cooler, and we'd open the windows. But I was always afraid that if I didn't have the sheets at least on my feet, the witches were going to get me.
Oh, you had them too.
What witches from where? I don't. But
don't
I was
let your
terrified.
Bare foot hang over the bed. I got that.
So, but much like you walking into the living room and saying, "Okay, whoever, come get me,"
and then some. Yeah,
I took the sheets off my feet and I laid there one night trembling. And woke up the next morning, and the sheet was still off my feet, and no witches had gotten me.
Yeah.
Amazing.
They didn't get you.
Nope.
No, I got you loud and clear. Okay, we're just about out of time. Now that I'm one other thing real quick. When I had the fear, I would get this tingling in the back of my neck and the back of my head.
Yeah.
And I was and I moved into this house once, and it came back, and it was almost like there was ghosts there. Well, I was in there, and then they moved away, and I moved into another house, and I felt the tingling. And then I moved one more time, and then I came to the conclusion that there wasn't ghosts in the house. It was me. I mean, it was everywhere I went. That's where the feeling was.
But I was going to say, and everywhere you go, there you are.
But being macho, I don't admit to these things.
Well, that's something nobody's hearing us. Yeah.
No, good, good. John Wayne would never allow that to happen.
No.
I got
so the big
it.
Three,
okay.
Failure, whoops. Loss, and fear, you don't have to get your, you don't have to let your confidence be killed. There you go.
Absolutely. Okay, website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com. And coming soon, by the way, you can find the book there and lots of other interesting things, articles and blog posts. We are also, as we speak, creating the brand new website for the Backbone Institute. So I hope to be announcing that hopefully in the next 30 days or so.
Oh, love every second of that. Susan Marshall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael Ray. Bye-bye.
Okay, good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore.
Mayor Eisenstein back with us, the author of Give Birth at Home with the Home Birth Advantage, and that's Safer Medicine, Don't Vaccinate Before You Educate. That's the other one. Unavoidably Dangerous Medical Hazards of HRT and Unlocking Nature's Pharmacy. And let's say, Mayor, hi, welcome back.
Oh, welcome, Michael Ray. It's a wonderful evening. We're going to be listening to the Republicans' candidates debate for president, and tomorrow we'll get a chance to listen to the president spend another $1 trillion or want to spend $1 trillion. What could be better?
Oh, wait, this even gets better. As a matter of fact, the bus tour he took, were you aware that the bus didn't tour? The bus went on a plane. The plane went to the next, and this is real.
Oh my God.
The plane went to the next city. The plane came off the plane and they went to where they went. $1.3 million for a Canadian bus.
Oh my God. Just pathetic. But let's talk about something very, important right now. You know, cause that's trivial matters. He's not going to be around very much longer. I mean, that's, we're starting to get into the fall season here in the Midwest. It's all of a sudden we're starting to feel the chill in the air. And as the chill comes into the air, it reminds us that summer is over and we really have to be meticulous about our vitamin D levels because, as everyone knows, vitamin D is produced by exposure to the sun. And, but even then we don't get enough. We need some supplementation. But now come the winter, we need even more supplementation. But some of the most exciting research is done and reported in a website called vitamindcouncil.org. Just the way it sounds, vitamindcouncil.org. It's sponsored by a wonderful doctor, and all of a sudden I go blank on his name, but I'll Dr. John Cannell. And this issue, and he has a complimentary newsletter, so I think everyone should kind of take a look at it. He talks about the link between vitamin D and cancer. And we've talked about this many, many times. But Dennis Mangan, who's the head of one of the clinical laboratories in this country, made the statement, vitamin D is like the holy grail of cancer. A drop in cancer rates because of vitamin D levels is greater than that for quitting smoking or indeed any other countermeasure in existence.
Well,
how crazy is that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like all this money we're spending, you know, on treating cancer, you know, and preventing cancer and all the mammo scams and then colon screens. Nothing even comes even close. And he came up with kind of a number, and it's not even really that high a number, that you want your vitamin D level to be above 40. And here are some of the things that they found. These are the 10 facts on vitamin D and cancer. Many studies have found that solar ultraviolet, that's vitamin D, is associated with a reduced risk in breast, colon, and rectal cancer. A randomized control of 1,100 units a day, not very much. You know, a vitamin D3 found a 77% reduction in all cancer instances. But let me go to the bottom of the list here that I wanted. Observational studies found the risk of breast, colon, and rectal cancer falls as blood vitamin D level rise to over 40 nanograms per ml. 40, it's not a very high number. I like to see it at least 60 to 80. But even just getting it to 40, they found a significant drop in all these types of cancers. I mean, it just, and of course, the most controlling ones, that the cancer rates in the northern hemisphere, the northern part of the United States, are a fraction of that in the southern Texas, southern California, southern Florida, but not people who migrate there later in life. These are people who live there all their life.
Now, by the way, and you and I have talked about this for years now, that no matter what you take, you know, there's nothing cures anything. What things do is they shore up that immune system. And if the immune system is functioning and you got the proper immune response, the body is working. Am I close here not being a doctor?
You're 100% right. 100% right.
Okay, now let me finish this because I think it's something very important. Glyconutrient complex extremely important. The winter's coming in, vitamin D, absolutely. But the glyconutrients, the components, the cell signaling molecules, that's extremely important because we're talking about intercellular communication. And if we have that and there's not a disconnect and it gets to our immune system, our life is better. And if we really come down to it, the glyconutrient complex that you've got over there is really something that you should shore yourself up with as winter's coming as a complement to the vitamin D3.
I totally agree. You know, I mean, but if you only do one thing, we've said this so many times, you know, but here's just some more and more evidence. And if someone wants to really read, just go to the vitamindcouncil.org website. You can read for weeks and weeks. Dr. Cannell has gone out of his mind putting all the, I mean, he's become obsessed with it, legitimately obsessed with the problems with vitamin D. He said no one's listening, but Dr. Cannell, we've got at least two listeners right here. Michael Ray and myself, we are listening, you know. And you know, it's kind of like if there's one thing you want to do, because a lot of times you tell people do this, they get overwhelmed, they decide to do nothing. So I want to make sure that everyone does this because it's so simple. And if you don't want to get a blood test, don't get a blood test. Just take the vitamin D. The blood test is just going to show you, if you're not taking it, how low your levels are.
No, by the way, one of the reasons I know I pushed the glyconutrient for a moment, but I'm sitting here with the Home First Natural Pharmacy Source, the product catalog. And for as long as we've known each other, every time I've got a problem, I go through the catalog, I find something, and then I end up getting fixed. And I think it's critical, the vitamin D3, absolutely. But there are other things that you offer, and I don't want to neutralize the power of some of the things in this catalog.
Let me, that's so sweet of you, because, you know, just a couple days ago, my wife, Karen, was having pain in her shoulder. I mean, really, really bad pain, you know, and it was just kind of like a numbness and a tingling. And she started taking our Allflex Plus. She was taking a pharmaceutical for a day or two, you know, which didn't do anything. And then she said, that's silly. I'm going to take more of the Allflex capsules. Within a day or two, all her pain went away. I couldn't get over that because I know how well it works.
Sure.
But this is simple, inexpensive, and works very, very well. I mean, it's got lots of anti-inflammatories in there, natural anti-inflammatories. You know, and the reason why I find this interesting, because the former coach of the Chicago Bears, Mike Ditka, is going to be speaking at the same conference in December that I'm speaking at, and he's going to be talking about chronic pain in football players after they retire and what they can do. And he's coming to a convention of doctors who try to look at a more natural way of things, doing things. He's giving the keynote address, but I know he's also coming to find some suggestions what to do for these hundreds of former football players who literally are walking around every day in pain. You know, and I'm going to make up for him a Allflex Pro with probiotics bottle, and I'm going to put his picture on it and bring it to him.
I love it. Okay, but when you really come down to it, I've used it for a long time. I'm not a retired football player, but I'll tell you what, you get up to my age and you work out as many years as I've worked out. When you get up in the morning, everything hurts. And the Allflex really works well because whatever it does to the muscles, it does a nice job.
Yeah, let me tell you something. And you know, sometimes you don't even know why some things work, but there's a lot of scientific evidence that the ingredients that we put together there, they work. And I've always had this theory, it's not my theory, but that if you put four or five things together that work in a natural environment, it works. But in a pharmaceutical environment, they seem to work against each other. It's kind of like having a balanced meal requires your vegetables, your salad, and you can put it all in the same plate and it'll work real well. But in the pharmaceutical realm, because the chemicals are so specific and have so many side effects, if you start taking two or three different pharmaceuticals, you're gonna have to start looking at all the ways they can interact with each other. And what we learned in medical school was you couldn't blend things together because their side effects got exacerbated, not their potential benefits.
No question about it. And I really believe when you come down to it, if you target the problem and not work on the symptoms, if you target the problem and you get underneath it to what's really causing I'm going to use the word disconnect again. You know, the whether it's the pain or the discomfort, or you know, if it's an uncontrollable urinary tract, whatever the case may be. If you work on it with some of the natural things that have been working for years and years and years and years, you can get away from, you just said it, get away from the side effects, go right to the heart of it, get rid of the inflammation, get rid of the things that cause the problems. And I really believe in the end result, you save yourself, you know, tens of thousands of dollars that you didn't have to go, quote unquote, to the doctor with.
Exactly. Now, I want to mention one thing. I want something fun, because all the stuff we're talking about, it's not unfun, but a chocolate and cocoa polyphenols vindicated. There's a big study that just came out which shows that they actually are beneficial for heart disease. Now, I'm not talking about chocolate bars like you buy in the store. We're talking about defatted cocoa, you know, and we carry some in our product line. Go to homefirst.com, go to the store, take a look at it. We have a product called Cocoa Pro. But let me read you some of the stuff here. It's so fascinating. Researchers from the University of Cambridge have finally published solid evidence to demonstrate the consumption of defatted chocolate is associated with improved heart and vascular health. Writing in the prestigious British Medical Journal, Dr. Franco and his team determined several factors, including diet, exercise, body weight control, and lifestyle changes, could help reduce the risk of heart attack. But he said that the anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties of cocoa could reduce heart disease risk by one-third, and could also reduce the risk of sudden death from heart attack and stroke.
Well, I want to talk about one other thing. Let me see my timing here. Okay, I got a couple of minutes to do this because I think it's extremely important. There was an interview that had gone on, and I think it was it might have been last night or the last part of last week. But anyways, it was about prostate cancer. And a very interesting thing that the doctor said that I hadn't thought about before, because I asked is there anything, you know, for preventative, is there any symptoms, signs, or something that you see it coming on? And he gave me a very interesting answer. Mayor, he said, no, you don't experience it coming on. It's just you just don't know, and there's no way to tell that it's coming on without, obviously, the blood test and the rest of it. So I want to talk about the prostate support that you have. And this is what triggered me with the lycopene and the rest of it, the stinging nettle and all of those things that help, the pumpkin seed oil. The problem is in what I just said. If you don't know it's coming on until after you've got it, it's too late. And I think every man will have prostate cancer. If you die when you're 70 years old, they'll probably find some of it in you. Some of us get it early and some of us don't get it early. But instead of waiting for some kind of a symptom that doesn't come, I would recommend highly to anybody, get the support. Do something ahead of time, because even if you don't feel it, it's there.
Oh boy, that's so beautifully said, and it's something I haven't thought about and talked about a lot. And I put this together quite a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and I take it every day. You know, and that's like you said, the salt palmetto, the lycopene, all ingredients which have been natural ingredients, have been shown to lower the probability of prostate cancer. I can tell you, we could talk about next week, just progesterone cream, something very, very beneficial, which we could talk about a little bit. So we'll give a teaser for next week.
Love every second of it. Website we can find you at?
Homefirst.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. And enjoy the week. Enjoy football coming back.
Hey, absolutely. Talk to you next week. Take care. Have a good
one. Be well, my dear friend. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Her parents had gone to their final reward, leaving their baby behind. Did you hear this poor little child was only 9 years of age when mother and dad went away? Still she bravely worked at the one thing she knew to earn her few pennies a day. She made artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of fashion to wear. She made artificial flowers, you know, those artificial flowers, fashioned from Annie's despair. With
paper and shears with some wire and wax. She made up each tool up and mum. Snowflakes drifted into her tenement room. Her baby little fingers grew numb from making artificial flowers. Artificial flowers. Flowers for ladies of high fashion to wear.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Patrick Ryan with us. He's the author of Awakened Wisdom, A Guide to Reclaiming Your Brilliance. Patrick died from a drug overdose in his late teens, only to be revived with a new understanding of the divine. Now, as a Buddhist monk in Burma, he practiced the path of awakening living. According to the Buddhist philosophy, he also studied indigenous wisdoms with a variety of teachers. The best-selling Awakened Wisdom blends Buddhist, native, and collected wisdoms into a beautifully crafted healing message for our modern culture. And let us say, Patrick, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray. It's my pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much. Dying, Patrick, what is dying? Do we have a definition of that?
Well, I don't think there's a definition that we're all agreed on. I would call it a transition from this physical life into a other way of being where our essence carries on.
Yeah, but by the way, when I was reading the bio just now, I just got a definition of dying for you. Dying for you was an awakening. But how did that awakening come? You came back. Where was it? What was it that caused you to have the expanded consciousness that you ended up with?
Well, you know, as we go through life, we have, I think this is true for everybody to greater or lesser degrees, life gives us many opportunities through which we experience an expansion of our consciousness. So in my case, it was a physically dying, and then again, in my time as a monk, there was experiences that I had that supported an expansion of my consciousness. I would say that there's a lot of people in the world right now that are going through challenges of, say, not having jobs, transitions being thrown upon them, that kind of stuff. And those challenges are putting those people into opportunities of expanded consciousness as well.
No, but that's the key. The opportunities, that's the word, and if you realize it, it's a tremendous opportunity. If you don't, then you can quote-unquote take it to the grave with you because it's going to kill you one way or the other with the pressure and all of the health problems that go along with it. I really believe in my heart of hearts what I've learned over all of the years that I've run around this planet, and there's been a few, is that no matter what the challenge is, if you can just gut it out and look through it, you're going to find a gift or a blessing or whatever it is at the end of the rainbow.
You're right on the money, Michael Ray. And, you know, everybody in the planet right now is here at a time when there's major change going on. Just look at the economic roller coaster we've been on for the last 3 years and the amount of, like, war and conflict that's been going on in the planet for the last 10 years. And these are all changes that there's this transition that we're all going through as a human race together. And that kind of transition is going to take people and shake them down to the core of who they are. And as you said, in that moment, you either have the opportunity to embrace the fact that there's something here to learn from it, or you can resist it and resist it and resist it. But eventually that's just going to wear you down.
Well, and by the way, when we take a look at the what is happening right now, look at the battle of the cultures right now. You know, the separations of the ethnicities, the separations of the political philosophies, the ideologies, and look what's going on with the planet right now. There's got to be a total vibration that runs the universe, runs the planet. And when that vibration is not in harmony, homeostasis, balance, then you get all these things going on. And if we can't look at what's going on right now and realize that it's just saying, stop and take a look at where you're going, or you're going to be in a real bad place here.
Yeah, and I've been fortunate over the last few years that I've been invited to deliver the Awakened Wisdom work in Islamic cultures, in North America, to North American cultures, in Europe, in Asia. And, you know, when you put all of the structures and religions off to the side and you get some people in the room together and we start talking about our hopes, our dreams, the kind of life that we want to be living, I tell you, people are dreaming the same story all around the world. So it's baffling that at some level different cultures can be at war with each other. And in fact, it's not entire cultures that are at war with each other. It's groups within the cultures. And yet all we are at the end of the day are people that just want to live a life of joy and peace and happiness and prosperity.
That applies to politics today. There, you know, we used to have, you know, Democrats and Republicans. We don't have that anymore. We have the Democrat, we have the liberal, we have the progressive, we have the Republican. I mean, you know, the same with both of them. And there, it's the extremes, and it's the same thing with countries. Those leaders of the countries that want the power and everything else that goes with it. It's not the base people themselves. It's those people who happen to have gotten in charge, and whatever the case may be is where the confusion is starting. And the average person, I really truly believe in my heart of hearts, I happen to be Jewish. And I believe if I sat down, if I went to an Islamic country and I just sat down with a family for dinner, I would not find them too much different than I am. And I think if you went to every country, when you get into the populace, you get into the population where their intent at the end of the day is not to garner as much wealth and power as they possibly can, you might find a completely different message there that underlies, that drives the way they think, they feel, and they live.
Absolutely right. And so in response to that, one of the things that I'm asking people to do is to put some conscious, intentional work into getting more clear about their calling and their vision here at this time in the history of their life. Because the visions that we held even 5 years ago may no longer be as relevant. The world was different even just 5 years ago, which
sure
is amazing, you know, that the whole world can be so revolutionized in the course of 5 years. And so when people can take the time and the opportunity to get more clear about the vision that's calling them and how that taps into their personal genius, their talent, and their skills, then what results from that is everybody will find the best use of them. And when people are living from the best use of them in the world, then they are experiencing the joy and happiness that they want. And when people are having that kind of a life, one of the results of that is people's hearts and minds open up again, and we can start seeing each other for the humans we are instead of people across a divide of different belief systems.
And part of the wisdom that you talk about divides three intelligence that we have access to. What are we talking about? And if that's something that's beneficial, how do we touch it? How do we grasp it and become part of it?
Yes. You know, we experience the world in every moment of our life through our mind intelligence, our heart intelligence, and our body intelligence. And our mind intelligence is just what it sounds. That's the realm of our thoughts, our ideas, our ability to analyze and assess what's going on. Our heart intelligence is the emotional experience that we're having in any given moment, and also that sense of connection and interrelatedness to all the beings. And the body intelligence is both our physical body and the five senses and the experience that we're having physically, and the body intelligence externally are also the things we build in the world. And every one of us specializes in one of these three intelligences, and we push one of them the furthest away, and then the other one is what I call Plan B. So what we want to learn how to do, number one, is come to know yourself, to know which intelligence is the one you specialize in. And then in the book, I give a lot of exercises that people can use to learn how to open up and integrate all three of these intelligences, because every one of them provides an important source of wisdom as people are going through decision-making processes in every moment of their life. One example that a lot of people could relate to is the idea of falling in love. You know, everybody's had that experience, you know, at some time. I hope they've had it many times and they're having it today. You know, that idea of falling in love, and sometimes the heart intelligence is caught in the emotion of that experience, and that sense of connection is pulling the person in. And the mind might be screaming, whoa, what's going on here? I don't understand this. And there might be confusion around it and stress around it. And then, of course, the body picks up all that confusion and stress and starts responding physically to that. So that's just a quick example of how all three of these intelligences are at work all the time.
Now, by the way, when you revived, quote-unquote, did you fall into the wisdom, or is the wisdom a collection of everything you learned along the way?
It's a collection. You know, in my experience of transcending and touching over on the other side, it took years after I came back before I could articulate and start to understand what that experience was about. And the divine, that the universe that is so beyond our ability to fully comprehend it, that no matter how I would try to describe my experience, it would never fully capture it. And that's such an amazing, I think, inspiring point for all of us to know, is that we're always supported, we're always being helped, we're always being resourced by the universe. And one of the things that I came away from that experience really, really clear about is, number one, that the universe itself at that level is a field of divine love and divine joy, because that was my profound experience, and that we are always in connection. And the universe, from the universe's point of view, it's always there wanting to be in connection with us. And from the human side, we will tend to shut it out. And the good news about that is then it's easy, because then the work is ours to open up. It's not like the universe is sitting in judgment of us. In fact, from the universe's point of view, there's really nothing personal in it. It's either we're open to it, therefore we're in relationship, or we've shut it off, and the universe is just standing by going, anytime you want to let me in, I'm right here.
So in essence, what you're saying and what I'm hearing you say is that we all have the absolute control. We have the option. All we have to do is allow it. If you disallow it, you're not going to experience any of it, and you're going to go through in a limited, quote-unquote, existence. But if you just open up, just take a little bit of a shift in thinking and allow it to happen, it's all in front of you.
That's right. The only word I might switch out is instead of control, I would say choice. There is nothing in this universe we control, and everything in this universe we can have influence on it. And so it really begins with the choice we make, the choice to respond in this moment in the highest and best way possible. And one of the ideas I talk about in the book is that we all have our own value systems. So I don't want to put my value system on the readers or the listeners right now, but I do suggest a couple of criteria so that you can know how you're doing in any given moment. And the two criteria are, is the thought, word, or action that you're in this moment creating beauty in the world? And is that thought, word, or action putting life-giving energy out into the world? And if you can answer yes to those questions, then it's very likely that you are responding in this moment from a place of what I call your divine essence, which is a place of openness and awareness of the interrelatedness of us all.
And, you know, the openness is a very interesting word, because there's so many people frightened to death, Patrick, to really say open today, because if they're open, something's going to hit them from one place or another. So it takes a lot of guts, but at the same time, you just have to make the decision to do it. Once you've got it, then you'll come in contact with other people that have it. I think the biggest problem that most people have is they feel that if they experience something, they're alone. And you're not alone. Never alone.
You're right. You're never alone. And you're right. This idea of openness sometimes seems counterintuitive. It's like, wow, it feels like the world is pushing on me. So what people want to do in that case is brace and constrict. And when you constrict, then you are abandoning your spontaneity and your flexibility and your wisdom, and you are going to get whacked by the world. So it is a little counterintuitive. It's like standing out in the middle of a freeway with cars zooming right by you and just opening up your heart and your mind, knowing that from this place you can move in a way that is so attuned to what is needed moment by moment.
And by the way, Patrick, we're starting to run out of time now. Is there a website that we can find you at, find out where we can get the book and also some of the workshops and the places that you'll appear at?
Yeah, thank you. The website is awakenedwisdom.com. That's A-W-A-K-E-N-E-D, wisdom.com. And on the homepage of the website, there's a free 21-day Vision to Action Challenge. And we just launched this a few days ago, and we've already got people signed up from all around the world. It's like almost every 10 minutes we're seeing registrations coming through in this thing. And every day for 21 days, people will receive a video teaching on how to take their vision and move it into action in the world. And I hope people enjoy it. We've created it just as one way we can be of service to what's going on this planet right now.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me here. Take care.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't anymore. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. Out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Tears and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you.